Hello.
Hey, Sammy Shah. I got the right number this time.
Oh, yeah. Benjamin Law's phone died a couple of days ago.
Just his phone, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he's fine. Absolutely okay. And when he returns, he'll be a new man. Please, don't worry about him for a second more. I'm the biggest fan he has, and I'm taking excellent care of him.
I'm filled with confidence, Sammy Shah. Shall we stop everything? And yes, it is time to stop everything on RN and online. We're part of the Hub family, picking apart popular culture. I'm Beverly Wang.
I'm Sammy Shaw.
And I'm Lauren Rosewarne.
So this week, guys, we're talking about fandom and hashtag delete Facebook. But first, Married at First Sight. An epic season has just wrapped.
Should we talk about the boring boys night?
Yes, he's told you everything. What's he told you?
I wouldn't be comfortable if someone was offering my wife to the rest of the men at the table.
No offense to Tracy, but her looks are not her best quality.
Shit.
You know what? I don't want my looks to be my best quality because I've got so many better qualities.
I know, it's not an insult. You've got a lot of good qualities.
Women like you think they can just get away with it because of the way you look.
I'm on national television. How on earth would I get away with that?
Davina, you're blaming the experiment, but to be honest with you, what happens on camera is what you people did. You're old enough, smart enough to understand consequences. Darling, you've got to grow up, and it's not all about hashtag Davina, hashtag coconut oil.
That's from the finale of Married at First Sight, which wrapped this week with so many bombshells and a very memorable hashtag coconut oil that makes me laugh whenever I hear it, that trended to the top of Twitter. So whether you watched it because it was so over the top that you couldn't look away, or because you thought it was exposing something about the state of relationships between men and women in Australia, or any other reason, the show has been a winner for Channel 9.
The finale on Wednesday was number one across all metro markets and across age groups from 16 to 54, and is the top overall ratings hit for the first quarter of 2018. It was the number one program for 6 of 8 weeks it was on air.
Yes, some indisputable numbers there. Now, for the past little while, it either feels like you watched it or spent time talking about why you don't watch it. Does that sound about right, Lauren?
Yeah, definitely. It feels like one of those shows that even if you've never seen an episode, you feel like you've watched it culturally. There seems like there's a lot of chatter about it happening.
Exactly the reason why we're talking about it on Stop Everything. I've watched it a few episodes. I found that it really does pull you in. Now, James Weir also knows that feeling because he spent a good chunk of his time wedded to Married at First Sight, having recapped all 5 seasons for news.com.au. James, hello.
G'day.
Hey, finally you can have a break, hey?
I know, hey, Jesus, my head's still spinning.
What do you think made the show such a hit this time?
It's the drama. I mean, the audiences for this series, you know, the 4 series that it's been on air, the 5 series that it's been on air over 4 years, it's been slowly building. We were hitting these kinds of numbers towards the end of last year, but certainly this year it became the juggernaut and it toppled My Kitchen Rules, which had sort of held juggernaut status for the last few years. And a lot of programmers from a programming perspective and executives in TV networks thought you could never topple My Kitchen Rules. It was just something that you couldn't mess with. But this year, there were affairs, there were drama. I mean, in that clip that you played at the top of this segment, we've got two couples talking about the affair that two of those people had. And we've got we're listening to audio of this man saying that his wife's looks aren't her best qualities and playing that footage to her face just to get a reaction. I mean, it's cruel and it's torturous, and it's something that we've just never really seen on a TV show before.
James, I like this idea of affair. Do you think viewers are buying into this, that this is actual infidelity that we're seeing play out?
Look, I think the kinds of viewers that watch this show and that take part in the Twitter conversation, everyone's in it for the joke a little bit, you know, and sort of in it for the punchline and in it for the embellishment. And if we can call it an affair just so we can get a little bit sort of riled about it and chase people through Twitter feeds with our sharpened hashtags, then we're going to call it an affair.
So we put a question up on the RN The Hub Facebook page asking people whether they had seen it. I want to thank all the people who didn't watch the show but bothered to leave a comment telling us that they hadn't spent a single second watching the show. They wanted to make that very clear. But a few people talked about the craft involved. Tracy said, fairy floss viewing from my tired brain. It used all the tricks and tools of great storytelling, drama, villains, vixens, chess, heartbreak, and surprise happy ever afters. Lisa said, it was great TV. I've got a meat degree in media studies, and I'm super critical of most reality shows, but this one got the mix just right. Made me laugh in parts where it was clearly staged. It still did really well. Stage or not, real humanity did play out between the spoon-fed soap opera drama. James, to get people to tune in four nights in a row for 8 weeks has got to have a lot of skill involved, hey?
Oh, it's an art, you know? And I think what we see with a series like Married at First Sight is it moves away from traditional kinds of reality shows and ones just like it, like romance ones like The Bachelor, which are very episodic and self-contained, and there's a setup and there's a conclusion and someone goes at the end of each episode. What the smart thing that is that they do with Married at First Sight is they do the storylining almost like you would see in a scripted drama, where they set these people up very early on and they get audience engagement and investment in their lives right there in those first week or two. And then they drop a bombshell and they extend it maybe over a week. And then in the middle of that, they'll drop another bombshell and extend that over 2 weeks. So you've got these complex storylines that are then arcing over a two-month period. And that's where you really get the investment, because as a viewer, you really want to know what's going to happen to these people and how is this going to conclude.
This is Stop Everything, and we're talking about Married at First Sight, which has just wrapped. You're hearing from James Weir, a journalist who's recapped all five seasons of the show and is now putting his feet up for a little while. Now, speaking of viewership, we have some very dedicated viewers right here in the RN office.
I've never watched Married at First Sight before, and I can't recall the moment where I was suddenly obsessed. I was mesmerised with the plastic surgery. That was just astonishing. I was astounded that these people would volunteer for such a weird experiment and then saline straight out of soap operas to be, I need your respect, Dean.
Yeah, it's kind of you can't look away. Like, I find myself sometimes watching it with my hands over my eyes, like one hand, like looking through my fingers, because sometimes it's so horrifying. But it's almost kind of like a spectator sport as well. I really liked also the fact that I was shocked by what people were doing. I liked the fact that I guess, got to judge their behaviour and psychoanalyse them. And I also, I did love the fact that this season, and I think it's a bit timely, and I'm not saying that Married at First Sight is part of the Me Too movement or anything like that, but I do think that they have picked up on some of those themes, in that they eventually did not let the guys get away with that sort of locker room talk, which I thought was good.
I think the other part of me enjoying it is kind of second guessing what's going on behind the scenes, how many buttons are being pushed, how much participation is actually goaded on by the producers, because we know it's not real.
The fact that I know it's not real, I think in some ways gives me more enjoyment, because I can watch it for the craft of what they're creating, because they're actually creating a drama, but they're just using real people. Anyway, I'm sad it's over, and, you know, I may have reached peak Married at First Sight, but I certainly enjoyed the process and I have no regrets.
That's no regrets from two RN staff members who've asked to remain nameless while sharing their views on Married at First Sight. James, they raised some really interesting points there. And one of the things that I appreciated in the honesty there is the judgment, the license to judge, and the deliciousness. It may be wrong, but come on, we all judge. I mean, do you think, did you feel that as well as recapping and diving into this series?
You do. I mean, and you feel that with every series because ultimately you're just judging people's actions and reactions. But I think sort of what people shamelessly did for this series was judging on real superficial things. So we heard one of the staff members there sort of talking about the plastic surgery, and that's not a bad thing because everyone was thinking this. I mean, we were looking at these lips and I was certainly making comments on, you know, some Kylie Jenner style lips. Like, they were pretty impressive, mate. And, you know, a lot of people just sort of putting their opinions out on Twitter, creating memes around these people going, it was just, it was outrageous. Everything from the aesthetics down to the drama and what we were watching was outrageous. And that's where it became just, you had to judge it.
We keep talking, James, about how this is a reality TV show and thus everyone knows it's fiction, it's not real. But at the same time, one of the people on the show suffered real life online abuse where people were reacting as if, you know, she was Cersei Lannister from Game of Thrones, but treating her differently because she's a real person. Does a show like this, which kind of caters to our basest viewing instincts, then cause us to react with our basest expressive instincts as well?
Well, the debate around sort of what's real and what's not with these shows is really interesting because, you know, as someone sort of who's involved on sort of watching it as a viewer, but also privy to a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, I do have a lot of conversations with the production house that makes these shows. I think it was so much easier to, you know, maybe even 5 years ago, to fake a lot of the drama in this show and no one would ever find out. It was just like sort of, you know, back in the day, you know, in breakfast radio, if you could, you know, if you got a fake caller on air, no one would ever know. But you can't do that kind of stuff anymore because someone's mum will come out on Facebook and say, well, no, they, you know, they paid them $10,000 to do that and now Australia's turned against them. You know, that didn't happen. It's too easy to out the fakeness with that. So you've got to be a little bit more careful. I think what we find sort of in terms of fakeness and what's confected is the situations are certainly set up and these people are paired together. Maybe they shouldn't be paired together and that's where they're going to get the drama from. They'll be put in a situation that stresses them, but what you do get is a genuine reaction. And of course, then it's embellished and enhanced in terms of smart editing and the way things are spliced together. But for a lot of these people, they come out afterwards and they do say, I didn't expect this to happen. I'm not a terrible person. But the reason why a lot of these people are cast on this show is they're brutally unaware of themselves. And having interviewed a lot of the people on this series and many others like it, you do find they're just not aware of themselves. And they don't know that maybe they're a bully in their life or they're very selfish in real life. Or, you know, they're very blunt when they talk and that doesn't come off very positively on them. They don't see it until it's reflected back at them in this mirror of a reality show.
So is that... I mean, the question of ethics kind of comes in here, doesn't it? It's a show that tags itself as Can Science Find Your Soulmate? But, I mean, there's not a lot of science in there. That's not something that would ever pass, like, an ethics committee at a university, say, Lauren.
Yeah, no, that's even laughable to even consider. The unawareness, I think, of participants, a key component of any ethics process is actually feeling totally confident that your participants know exactly what they're getting in for. The element of surprise, therefore, that this show relies on doesn't actually have that. But James, what I'm interested in is this concept of the art of the recap, how you balance both watching the show as someone who clearly enjoys aspects of it, but also balancing that with the cynicism. I mean, a lot of recaps are really grounded in this idea of the piss take, and that's not quite the style that you've gone with.
No, because I think, you know, over the years, you know, like you pointed out, sort of been doing it for a few years and you do kind of, you change sort of sometimes, particularly early on with how you do it. I mean, do you want to be like a total fan of the show or do you want to be a total enemy of the show and hate it? But either way, you're going to isolate parts of the audience. With a show like this, you've got 2 million people watching it in the end. So you want to appeal to those people who are really big fans of the show and are watching it for enjoyment. And you want to engage that conversation and the observations that they're making. But you also want to raise an eyebrow at it for the 45-year-old plumbers in regional Queensland who are only watching it in the background while their wives are watching it.
Sure, sure, just the background.
And yeah.
It's the wife's fault.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, from these emails that I get from these plumbers and these builders.
They're not engaged at all.
No, going, I don't watch the show, but Dean and Davina, I'm like, how do you know these people? Yeah, so you want to appeal to them as well and, you know, look at it with a raised eyebrow and go, well, you know, maybe this shouldn't have been happening or maybe this should have been happening and do a bit of a piss take there. So you, and that way sort of you include everyone and everyone feels like they're being heard.
Just on the idea, like, you've made a career out of recapping programs and I'm sure you encounter this, but when you tell people that you are a professional reality show recapper, I mean, what kind of reactions do you get? Is there snobbery there that you have to contend with?
There is. So you've got to kind of, like, I can't tell people that I'm a recapper. I go with, oh, you know, journalist, write a TV column, spin it that way. You know, I do stuff, I do other things.
Just war criminal, go with that.
yeah, exactly. I'm a political reporter. but the big question you get is, did you go to university?
Oh, wow.
That's what people want to know. Is there a course in this?
Yeah. There's not, no. Just kind of general high school bitchiness. If you're ever engaged in that, you can probably write a recap.
You could probably teach that course now, James.
Yeah.
And just talking about thinking about the insights that you have on the program, you've actually been on some of these shoots where you've attended the weddings. I mean, what's that atmosphere like when you're just in amongst strangers about to get fake married for camera?
Oh, it's really good when they don't know who you are. So they, you know, particularly with the weddings, there's all these families there and, you know, they take, and again, sort of whether or not, producers don't say that they do this to create drama, but from my observations, it helps. You know, one of the ones that I went to this year was two people who are from Adelaide who got paired together. For some reason, they flew them both up to Sydney and all their families up to Sydney. So everyone's in Sydney for no reason. They don't know.
Already out of their comfort zone.
It was like the hottest day in September in 10 years. It was the middle of the day at midday in this backyard of a mansion in Vaucluse, you know, big, expensive suburb in Sydney. Under the beating hot sun, there's no marquee. Everyone had been there since 10 o'clock because they said that's when the wedding would go on. The bride's still going around the block in a carriage, a horse-drawn carriage, by midday. So everyone's been sitting out there for 2 hours. The groom, who's, you know, just doesn't know what's going on, he's sweating, he's anxious, just standing in front of these strangers. And then it goes till about 11 o'clock at night and there's lots of alcohol involved. So it's just, I mean, it's not as compelling as the final edit that you see compacted to an hour on TV, but you certainly see the level of uncomfortableness that people are going through and the drunkenness draw on and how loose people can really get.
Oh, wow. James Weir, thank you so much for sharing the view of a serial unscripted television recapper with us. Hats off to you. James Weir is with news.com.au. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
And don't forget, you can leave your comments about Married at First Sight on the Hub's Facebook page and Twitter. Thanks to you who already have done so.
Talking in my sleep at night, making myself crazy. Out of my mind. Wrote it down and read it out, hoping it would save me. Too many times. My love, he makes it feel like nobody else. Nobody else. But my love, he doesn't love me. So I tell myself. One, don't pick up the phone. You know he's only calling cause he's drunk and alone.
Just a little musical interlude there. New rules, Dua Lipa. Look her up. She got in a little bit of a spat with entertainment reporter Richard Wilkins. A little bit amusing, that tit for tat. But anyway, moving on. This week, there is a proliferation of stories popping up on how to hashtag delete Facebook.
And this is in response to the data breaching involving 50 million user profiles scraped from Facebook via a personality testing app.
Correct. Now, if you want to learn more about it, there are many stories online about those allegations involving a firm called Cambridge Analytica. They obtained the data not just from app users, but all the people in their friends network as well. That's where this controversy is coming from. And then it's alleged that they use that information to try to influence voter behavior in the 2016 election. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg in an interview with CNN's Laurie Siegel.
Knowing what you know now, do you believe Facebook impacted the results of the 2016 election?
Oh, that is hard. You know, I think that it's really hard for me to have a full assessment of that.
He apologized, and this story will keep developing, but the upshot for us here on Stop Everything is the backlash. Not only did Facebook's stock price fall, it's taken a social capital as well.
That's right. So, Sammy and Lauren, people are really fired up about this. I just want to share a few comments I got when I asked people on Twitter and Facebook whether they were considering hashtag deleting Facebook. This is what John said. The Cambridge Analytica scandal is the proverbial straw. Despite facilitating connectivity, Facebook has become a social vampire, sucking life from people who strive to share contrived snapshots of time and events that bear no resemblance to real life. And Leah said, I'm surprised that people are surprised about Facebook. Its data mining origins and insanely intrusive terms and conditions have always been there. Being surprised that Facebook leaks your data is like being surprised the NSA would eavesdrop. Anyway, let's talk about hashtag delete Facebook with Ariel Bogle. She's the online technology reporter at the ABC. Hi, Ariel.
Good morning.
Ariel, this isn't the first time Facebook's felt a backlash for some dodgy practices. What's the difference this time around?
I think the big difference here might be Donald Trump. Anything connected to Trump and the 2016 election has become somewhat radioactive. So the idea that Facebook leaked data to an academic who then passed that data to Cambridge Analytica, who apparently used it to target people during the election and sway them towards Trump or sway them away from voting, that just feels like a really big deal to people.
Now, Ariel, even though people might want to leave Facebook, it's actually not easy considering how embedded it has become in our lives. Anne sent us a voice memo, and she told us she's weaning herself off Facebook with the intention of quitting entirely.
But you know what? It is so hard to delete Facebook because as I'm deleting my photos and information from Facebook, I keep feeling like I'm going to lose friends and connections, and that makes me feel guilty as hell. Another reason is that I get a lot of my news from Facebook. So I'm actively looking for another way to get news from different sources or in one place. Another reason is that I have a huge case of FOMO, and lots of smaller events are posted only on Facebook, and I'm not sure where else to find information about them. Another reason is that I belong to a few Facebook groups that were set up for the purpose of professional interactions. If I don't have a Facebook account, I might lose out on interacting with my peers and my colleagues.
Thanks to Anne for sending us that voice memo to thehub@abc.net.au. Ariel, she makes a few very strong and relatable points. Facebook is so embedded. We use it so much. There is no alternative right now that steps in for that.
Yeah, and there's also this argument that people who work in the media, like us in the room today, but generally people who have any kind of connection to what's going on in the outside world, seem to feel a justification that we need to stay on Facebook for work reasons. And I think this highlights an interesting thing of one hand feeling that we have to justify our social media use. On the other hand, this argument that why can't we control how we use Facebook? If you use it in a way that you're just receiving information as opposed to giving your data, is that not part of the solution here?
That's a very good point. I think there are ways to sort of tweak the platform to opt out of behavioural targeting, for example, to make sure everything in your feed is seen by friends only. But by nature, working on Facebook, using it, liking things, sharing photos, you are sharing data. That is just the bottom line. You're sharing data with Facebook that then uses that data to make itself an appealing platform for advertisers, and that's how they make money. You're right, there's not many good alternatives that just offer that full suite of functionality. Friends, connections, work groups, events in particular. That's one reason why I feel I can't get off Facebook, as your caller mentioned. I just don't know how I'd get all those party invites.
One of the things that I always wonder about the data itself is how valuable is it actually? I mean, Cambridge Analytica's entire selling point has been that they can influence an election using data harvested from Facebook. But that's their marketing model. They have to say that. How much of this is just people coming up with vague and terrible excuses for Donald Trump winning an election and not wanting to take responsibility for that?
That's a really good question. There's really not much evidence that psychographic targeting, which is what Cambridge Analytica claimed it could do, actually works. There's no real evidence that seeing a meme, for example, will change your vote from Labour to Liberal or anything like that. But nevertheless, I don't think we can be entirely complacent about it. certainly what you do online, your behaviour, indicates something about you. It might indicate a demographic that you're in, might demonstrate your interests or your political leanings. And it's not that people might target you with political ads and try and sway your vote. It could eventually be used to exclude you from certain things. There was a really interesting report from ProPublica last year that showed housing ads in the US were being targeted at certain people but excluding certain racial groups such as African Americans and Hispanics. So it's not just what you could be seeing, it's what you give to Facebook that could be keeping you from seeing things, which is a very good question too.
Do you think Facebook is getting a disproportionately rough deal here, given that any business that has, for example, a loyalty card is also keeping demographic data on us? It's just that it hasn't had its own scandal yet about, you know, an expose in the same way that Facebook has.
Yes, I think there's definitely a lot of room there for a lot of other companies to be asked these tough questions. But Facebook is unique in a way. It is has the revenue of a small country, you know, it has the power of a government. It has that many people on its platform. So I think it does deserve this very high level of scrutiny. It's in every country. It has so many users. It makes so much money from us. It deserves the scrutiny that it's getting. But certainly there are questions we could equally be asking of Google or even companies like Woolworths that have those loyalty cards. Woolworths actually works with a data broker called Quantium. They own part of it. And they use that data to target ads at you as well.
But the key at the heart of this issue, of course, is that your friends got their data scraped. So like you may have agreed to use this app, take this test and use this app. But the issue, I think the betrayal, the surprise is that, you know, it didn't just take my data, for example. It would have taken Lauren's and Sammy's and everybody else who I'm friends with on Facebook. And that's the not just the material problem, but a huge PR problem for Facebook at the moment. But Ariel, I mean, we don't know whether, time will only tell whether enough people will delete Facebook in order to actually push a change there or hurt them. I mean, do you have an idea of what that critical mass looks like?
Yeah, it would be really interesting to see if enough people quit to see Facebook like very legitimately change its business model. You know, we've seen these kinds of trends before. There was even Delete Uber a few years ago, you might remember, and Uber's still around.
Uber's fine.
Yeah, it would take a lot of people signing off to get shareholders worried, and those are the key constituents for Facebook at the end of the day. But there are other avenues for Facebook to be sort of prodded to change its ways, and that would be regulation and pressure from lawmakers as well.
I guess we'll have to wait till next week to see how many people delete Facebook, hey?
Let us know via Facebook.
Send us a note, that's right, or tweet us using the hashtag StopEverything. Ariel Bogle, online technology reporter for the ABC, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, a few weeks ago on Stop Everything, we touched on one aspect of fandom when we talked about fan fiction. Well, we are circling back today to explore fandom more deeply because it's like an onion. The more you peel back, the more interesting it gets. So, Sammy, you are a comic book fan, right?
Yeah, I've been one since I was, 7, maybe 8 years old. I now have in my possession upwards of a few thousands of comics.
Are you like the guy who has them all in the pristine plastic
bags?
No,
I'm not. I prefer to read them. I like having my hands on them.
One of each.
Are you wearing gloves?
No, but I am thinking of getting a Cyclops from X-Men tattoo now, which is just a thing I'm going through.
Full across the back, like Ben Affleck.
Of course,
please.
Who doesn't, right? Is there any other way to get a tattoo?
Go hard or go home. Now, if I think about some of the books I grew up with and the obsessive nature that I read them over and over again, probably a fan and I didn't realize it or a lapsed fan. Lauren, any interests of yours rise to the fan level?
Nah.
and done.
I really feel that when I went into university and then professionally as an academic, when I watch pop culture, I tend to be really critical of it. And not necessarily in a bad way, but I think it changes how you view material. And it leads you away from that ability to just relax into a show or into anything and become a true fan.
You've got that academic distance on.
I really do.
Well, let's just see how real fans compare with us run-of-the-mill fans. Or, Sammy, you're a real fan.
I know, I was going to take deep offense
right now. Take that back. Flourish Klink is a fandom researcher and Elizabeth Mingle is a fan culture journalist. Together, they co-host the Fansplaining podcast, which covers fandom across genres and so many angles. Welcome to Stop Everything.
Glad to be here.
Hello. Welcome. Now, Flourish, I'll start with you, but Elizabeth, I know you have a view as this on this as well, so I want you to come back and fill in the blanks and give your view. What is the difference between being a regular, everyday fan versus being part of, quote, fandom?
For me, there's a combination of things. The most important thing to me is that people who incorporate the thing they're a fan of into their own identity, into their own sense of self, to me, that's really the hallmark. Of course, some people would say that being part of fandom means you need to be part of a community. You have to talk to other fans. I'm not sure that's true. But for example, I can't think about myself without thinking about Star Trek anymore, right? Yeah. So that's that.
Old or new?
Or new.
Yeah, new, yeah.
That's
yeah.
True. All of them.
Okay, all of them. Okay, great.
Both of them.
Good answer. Elizabeth, how about you? How does the definition of fandom look like for you?
I think I define it a little more broadly, which shouldn't surprise Flourish based on our millions of conversations about this. I think it's really about self-definition. And so whether that means that you have this, you know, this internal idea of yourself as a fan, or, you know, you don't have to just self-describe that way or say, I'm a member of this fandom, a member of fandom at large. I think that you get to set those boundaries, because without that, then we wind up with, you know, gatekeeping and that sort of thing. I just think it's a lot broader, and there's a lot of different ways people can identify.
Is fandom an internet phenomenon? Did we have this prior to the ability to connect with other fans?
Well, absolutely. We did. I mean, we've always had the ability to connect with other fans just by talking with other people, right? So, for instance, the Bronte sisters wrote fan fiction, real person fan fiction about celebrities they were interested in.
Oh, wow.
So with fandom itself and the way it kind of develops as a culture, it's one of the hallmarks of it is a level of obsession. Does that affect the way people who aren't into fandom view fans? Are we seen as, you know, slightly unhinged?
Yes.
Sorry. Thanks, Laura.
Elizabeth, do you want to take that question?
We don't need a whole segment on that, Sammy.
Elizabeth, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's tricky right now, because I definitely think as fandom is really kind of aggressively mainstreamed over the past decade or so, I mean, there are different lines for different people, obviously. When you think about sports fandom, which has been, you know, a present kind of obsessive thing for a very long time, you know, in the era of mass media, you know, getting really, really into your team has always been seen as okay, kind of across the board. I think that that's shifting now. It's cool to like certain fanish things or like them in a fanish way, but I don't think all practices are accepted. I think that people still draw. I'm all about drawing lines in these answers, but there's still lines drawn, basically.
Well, that's a really interesting point that you just made, Elizabeth, because sporting fans are, they're mental, you know, they're so dedicated, but we kind of accept it as that's just part of mainstream life, whereas
other
fandoms are put kind of in the corner, like as a niche interest. So what do you think the division is there? Why are some aspects of fandom quite mainstream and acceptable, like wearing a cheese head, but then fan fiction or fan art is kind of put in a different category, like an underground category?
So gender is a huge factor here, obviously. Sports being, you know, this traditionally, whether it is in reality or not, male-dominated space. So it's not surprising you have a sports section in every newspaper. And I think you see a lot of the fan culture that's mainstreamed in the last, you know, the stuff that I'm talking about with the recent mainstreaming, also is a kind of male-dominated, you know, this comic book nerd guy kind of archetype, which obviously there are women doing this
we
as well.
We have one here.
We're looking at Sammy. Right. Adoringly.
Right. Whatever.
So, but you still find a lot of the, I mean, it's not to say, and obviously within the derision of that historically too has been related to gender. It's, you know, seen as emasculating if you, or you're emasculated if you are, you know, not this, you know, big strong jock, but you're into comic books or whatever. And I don't want to overstate the kind of, you know, the oppression of the nerd boy, because I think that gets us into another realm. But a lot of the practices that you still see people deriding are definitely female-dominated ones. Shipping, fan fiction, fan art, privileging of the romantic interpersonal relationships in what may be seen as others by others as an action film, that sort of thing.
This is Lauren. My interest in this gendered aspect is also the emasculation of liking something too much. Is there a sense that there is a gendered nature to being able to devote yourself wholly and enthusiastically, and that that's something we associate with women? I'm thinking, you know, scenes of Beatles or Justin Bieber concerts. We tend to associate emotion of that extent with women.
Absolutely. Flourish, you want to jump in here?
Sorry. I think that that's true, but I think that there's also something that a lot of people who are not part of fandom don't realize, which is that fan communities and fans can be highly critical, even hypercritical, of the things they love at the same time as being so embracing of it. So it's a real irony that some of the transformational fan practices, things like fan fiction, things like fan art, can be so derided when in reality they're one of the most critical things people do.
I want to ask you, Elizabeth, about this, which is that one of the things that's changed with the advent of the internet, particularly with Twitter and Facebook, is the interaction fans have with the creators of the content, you know, not just in sports, but also in books and movies and TV and all of these things. You can speak to the producer, the director, or the writer. Does that now reduce the space between those two? And is that healthy?
Yes and no. This is probably the topic that we talk about by far the most. We usually tag it fan creator interaction. And I know Flourish has a lot of thoughts on this too, so feel free to jump in. But I think this is the space where we see the vast majority of the tension. You know, there's an illusion that there is that open conduit. You know, I can love a TV show and just tweet at the writers or the actors or the creators. But it's an unequal relationship. And B, we're not actually having a conversation. We can see each other, but we actually can't in reality talk to each other in a real way. And I'm not even sure that we should be talking to each other in a real way. There's a lot of fans historically who kind of want to keep what fans call a fourth wall, which is different from the one in theater, where you want your fan activities to remain within fandom and not within sight of the creators. But then you have people in, you know, TV networks or whatever who want to capitalize on fanish interaction. And there's just some misunderstandings and miscommunications can really lead to some kind of bad behavior all around.
Flourish, the role you play on fansplaining is that you are the fan capitalist, right?
That is the running joke.
It seems that you love money. And if you listen to any episode of the Fansplaining podcast, it's definitely there. But that makes me very curious to hear about your perspective on that point.
Well, I got into the entertainment industry, right? I worked studying fandoms for major franchises, and I got into the entertainment industry because I was a fan and I saw those miscommunications, and I felt like, wow, there is no way that this is helpful to either fans or people in the industry. So yes, I do help franchises in my day job make more money off of fans, but I hope that I can also help fans not be as misunderstood, as dismissed, or, you know, just ignored by the properties that they love.
Do you help fans also make the crossover into being creators who can make money? I mean, when can you jump over from being a fan who just creates to kind of legitimizing, in a sense, because you are being paid to be part of the creative process from the front end, so to speak?
Absolutely. That's one of my passions, really, is trying to help fans who would like to make a jump into industry, which not all fans want to do, helping them make that jump. I really feel like, as much as it bothers me to say this, which it does bother me, we live in a capitalist society, and the way that people learn to respect things is when those things make money, right? That's sort of the benchmark people have for it. So I feel like fandom is becoming more respected as people move into industry and see it in a capitalist light, I guess.
What are you both fans of, Flourish and Elizabeth? I know, Flourish, that you are very much into Harry Potter, but tell us a little bit more about what your fandoms are.
Well, I started off in, I'm a serial fan, so I've been a fan of The X-Files. I was very into that. Then Harry Potter. And right now, in fact, for the past several years, I've been delving into Star Trek, the entire Star Trek, like I said earlier.
And Elizabeth?
Wait, you left out your main fandom, Flourish. Come on.
Oh, what is it?
Okay,
you can't hide from us.
I really love One Direction, and especially Harry Styles, because he is, in fact, right, the dreamiest.
There are a lot of, I'm going to take a stab and say you're a millennial. Yes?
Shocking.
There are a lot of millennial women round about the RN offices who share that interest. So you're not alone there. And kudos for you for being brave.
That's right. Own it.
That's right. Elizabeth, what about you? And Flourish, jump in and feel free to out her fandoms as well.
That's right. Yeah, I was also in the Harry Potter fandom for a long time. Unlike Flourish, who was a very, you know, organizing conferences and things, I was a deep level lurker for like the entirety of the 2000s.
A lurker is?
Lurker is someone who does not participate, which and back then, too, in the 90s and the first decade of the 21st century, too, it was basically all or nothing. You would have to comment if you wanted to participate. You'd have to join. Now you can kind of sort of passively like stuff. But then it was just really, like, deep in the shadows. Or you talk to people. And I did not talk to anyone. But right now my fandom is it's the pirate show Black Sails. And this is news to Flourish, but in the last week, I've been nonstop reading X-Men fic. So maybe that's my new fandom, actually.
Oh. What? I news cannot believe that this is
nothing
true.
Wrong with X-Men this, fiction.
No, it's just blowing my mind. It is not what I would have expected from Elizabeth.
That's right.
Wow.
I'll tell you all about it
I'm
afterwards.
I'm so excited.
I smell a new fansplaining podcast episode here. This is Stop Everything. I'm Beverly Wang with Sammy Shaw and Lauren Rosewarne. We're talking about fandom and fan communities with Flourish Klink and Elizabeth Minkle. They're both fandom aficionados and co-hosts of the podcast Fansplaining. If you're part of the fandom world, please tweet at us using the hashtag Stop Everything. Now, Flourish and Elizabeth, I want to talk about fans and how they're understood by the wider world, because I think the part of the reason that I find it so interesting is because it's not a part of the world that I'm involved in. And I think there is some, I guess, stigma or sometimes lack of respect involved with understanding that people can be so dedicated that to certain, you know, shows, anything, movies, TVs, books. I mean, what is it about fandom that you think attracts ridicule? Elizabeth.
Oh, so many things.
Yeah,
do
go
you
ahead.
Need to
go,
yeah. First?
Go, please, please.
Yeah. I mean, not to lean too much on the gendered thing, but I think that a lot of the stigma around female dominated fan practices, there's so many elements, actually, and I mean, Flourish should jump in and rescue me here to try to unpick this one. you know, there's definitely ideas of, like, with a lot of it, you know, Flourish, why don't you take this one for me?
Well, okay, so the two major ways that fans are ridiculed are they're either the sort of stalker individual, like, freak out person who, if they're male, is like the obsessed stalker who's going to, you know, try and shoot someone to impress Jodie Foster, or if they're female, they are, you know, lost in a world of fantasy and incapable of understanding reality, like Madame Bovary. Maybe
these are the stereotypes you're saying.
Right. Or you're the obsessed crowd. And if you're a guy, that's like a football mob. And if you're a girl, then that's a Beatlemaniac. Right. And so I think that it's all about people fearing that emotional self-regulation is impossible. Right. Like, if you love something too much, then it's socially improper. Like, and you're just going to fall over and be incapable of interacting with anyone else. And I mean, spoiler alert, that's not really true. Most people, I think, have something that, a book or a movie, something that is a lens through which they can see the world and understand their own life. And to me, that's the center of fandom.
A lot of the a lot of the culture around fandom has been sort of shaped by its expression in Western society. But one of the things that we're seeing more now is on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, people like myself who grew up in Pakistan, for example, or you know, kids in South Korea are coming out and saying, hey, I love X-Files, or hey, I loved Harry Potter. And what is it about fandom that actually gave them a sense of purpose or community, which, you know, might actually be taken for granted in some of the other places?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I can speak to internationally the way that those flows happen. It is amazing to see how people have started to connect across countries, not just, you know, people liking Western media, but also people in, like, the United States loving K-pop bands, for instance, right?
Elizabeth what do you
come
think?
Save me.
No saving necessary. We're taking it.
Yeah. We're not transcultural fandom experts, though. We are about to have one on the show. So Lori Morimoto, so if you want to check her work out, she's an ACA fan. But yeah, I mean, and I definitely think that obviously this is something that's really grown with the internet. You know, obviously, prior to a few decades ago, you certainly could have transcultural fandom, but not in the way now. And you know, there are also plenty of misunderstandings about the way that people across cultures interpret things or appropriate things. But I think it's also... It's sort of, I mean, there are two ways to look at it. I guess you can talk about, like, this kind of cultural hegemony or whatever, you know, especially if it's fans outside the United States kind of embracing American media properties. But that's a very cynical way to look at it. You can also look at it as saying these properties that people get fanish about. And you obviously can get fanish about anything, and I don't want to conflate pop culture, nerdy pop culture, with fandom. I think it's a really bad habit that people have right now. But, you know,
these so stories different.
Can... Yeah, this has been a growing, like, this has been my pet peeve for the last... Yeah. It's more like, you know, there's been a proliferation over the last few years of, quote-unquote, like, fandom news outlets or, you know, pop culture sites that are branding themselves as, like, fandom news. And it'll be, you know, the latest Marvel stuff, the latest Star Wars stuff, comic books, a very kind of narrow band of the sort of things that you'll see at San Diego Comic-Con, that kind of space. And it's sort of weird for me because, I mean, now I just admitted that I'm reading a lot of X-Men fics, so I guess that I can't say this anymore. But, you know, generally, I get fanish about other stuff, and it's not... I'm not, like, here for superheroes or here for science fiction or whatever. It's about a set of behaviors, not necessarily the object of my fandom.
So what is fannish behavior? Really... You said you get fannish about certain things. What does that mean? How does that look like?
Yeah. Oh, God. The last week
You've never seen fannish behavior until you've seen people get obsessive about telenovelas in Brazil, right? So loving something obsessively, right? And right. wanting more of it. And
yeah, so I mean, there's a ton of right. I mean, so there's a few different models of fandom. Obviously, there's, you know, the kind of collecting facts. People make wikis. People, you know, sharing information, being really invested in knowing every detail, reading every book in the Star Trek series, as one of us is doing right now. You know, there's also transformational fandom, which is fan writing fan fiction, drawing fan art, making videos, and. You know, there's a lot of people who just love fan fiction and they love the idea of it and they'll just read stories and they don't necessarily feel like they're like drowning in it. But then there's a lot of other people who will like, you know, just not be able to get enough about a specific character or a ship or something like that.
So, Elizabeth, it sounds like what you're referring to is not maybe being showy about what you like, but actually having very deep engagement and consuming a lot and really going deep, deep, deep with your interest. Does that sound... Like the
yeah. Well, I think some of it is performative, though. I think there's definitely ways that people can show, you know, either the depth of their knowledge that shows how much they love it, or you know, the amount of time they spent. Sometimes the amount of money they spent, which is obviously very problematic. You know, say like I've been to this many shows, I've been to this many conventions, that kind of thing. There are a lot of different ways that people can kind of measure that fanish capital, and it's not always knowing the most. Sometimes it's feeling the most, and people can definitely be performative about that, which obviously can not be great always, but you know.
So Flourish and Elizabeth, before we go, we do podcast recommendations every week, and since you're both podcasters, would you mind sharing some recommendations with us before you go? Elizabeth?
Yeah, absolutely. So full disclosure, the podcast that I want to recommend is done by two friends of mine. It's called Seriously. It's from The New Statesman, which is actually where I've done most of my writing on fan culture, hosted by Caroline Crampton and Anna Leskovitz. And I really love it because the tagline is taking pop culture seriously or something along those lines. And they, you know, they have really in-depth conversations about current and past pop culture. And they're not afraid to get fanish about it, but they're also not afraid to, you know, be pretty intellectual about it. And I just feel like there's an assumption that when you're fanish about stuff, that it's kind of this blind devotion, this sort of slavish devotion to stuff. But actually, as Flores was saying earlier, fans are quite critical, too. There's a lot of depth within these spaces. And I feel like this is one of the podcasts that really reflects that.
Well, we are fans of taking pop culture very seriously on this show, Stop Everything, so it's good to have another recommendation. Flourish Klink and Elizabeth Minkle, co-hosts of the Fansplaining podcast and fandom aficionados on the journalism and the analysis front. Thank you so much for joining us to talk through some of the aspects of fandom as well as sharing that podcast seriously. We'll put a link on our show page.
And you can get in touch with us, ourselves, on Stop Everything using the hashtag Stop Everything, or emailing us. The address is thehub@abc.net.au.
So, Sammy, I was thinking about you during that conversation, mm-hmm. whether you are actually a fan or one of those nerd boys.
No, I'm full-on nerd boy. I have come to terms with what I am a long time ago. I stopped fighting it and then I embrace it in all its deviant forms.
So do you see a division then between your nerd boyishness and the fandom that Flourish and Elizabeth were describing?
Not at all. I feel like that's basically been the evolution that's kind of happened. It used to just be most of us were kind of off in our own spaces, obsessively collecting things or reading things or writing our own things. And now because the internet, it's become a community, and then this community turned into commercial spaces like comic cons and conventions, and yeah, let's see where it goes next. But it's a pretty exciting thing to be into if you're into it. From the outside, it probably looks completely crazy.
Yeah, right. Well, Lauren, what did you think of the gendered aspect of fandom that Flourish and Elizabeth were drawing there?
Because this is always the cliche that fan art and fan fiction are all produced by women. We know that that's actually not true, and yet the stereotypes persist. And I think that's partly what Sammy was alluding to. The culture is changing. And I think that we hopefully, you'll see a breakdown in those stereotypes where men feel that it's not quite as emasculating as it might seem to admit your obsessions.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. And to the sharing front, let's share now. It's time for us to do our weekly sharing. What's on your consumption list this week, Sammy?
I feel like I should be saying something geekier than what I am watching because I've kind of, you know, put the cart before the horse here. But no, instead, I will recommend OCTB, or OCTB, I guess.
Yeah. What does that stand for?
OCTB, it's a Hong Kong-based show, and it's set in, it's a joint production between Hong Kong and China, and it is set in the waning days of the British handover of Hong Kong to the Chinese government. And it's about a policeman who goes into the mob there to kind of infiltrate it and break it down. The exciting thing about it is it's a crime noir show. There's many of those on TV and Netflix and all these things right now. But because this one's from Hong Kong and kind of has a different tone. It's funny when it should be somber. It's silly when it should be serious. Yet at the same time, it's compelling viewing. And if you're a Hong Kong movie nerd like I am, yeah, then there's a lot of like people from back in the day in Hong Kong cinema who are like guest appearances on there.
Oh, cool.
Background characters. So it's a lot of like spot the guy, spot the actor sometimes, but it is also really fun viewing. It's worth getting into half hour episodes, a whole bunch of them. So, you know, you got a nice deep binge ahead of you.
Awesome. That's OCTB on Netflix. And Lauren, what's on your list this week?
I'm continuing with the political theme. New Yorker magazine ran a article on Hope Hicks. Now, Hope Hicks is the very glamorous, but now former
outgoing communications director. Yeah.
at the White House. She replaced Mooch, Scaramucci, and so she hasn't been in the role that long. The article explored some of the interesting dynamics happening at the White House. My favourite was that Donald Trump, apparently, screams through several closed doors to get her attention. It made me reflect on my own time working in politics, where politicians literally would do the same thing. Through doors, Lauren, can you come and help me? They've just minimized a window on Windows.
Oh, you've got something in common with Hope Hicks then. There you go.
I really do. A slave to politician overlords, yes.
I started reading a column this week on thecut.com, and I really love this device. It's called I Think About This A Lot, and they're essays by different writers talking about something that they have fixated on. And it's a brilliant idea because sort of, I guess, a bit like fandom, it explores how you get intimate with moments or images that capture you, even though they've got nothing to do with your direct experience. And the one I read this week is about a grainy photo of Katie Holmes and Jamie Foxx. You know how they're rumored to be in this really low-key, long-term relationship, right?
Literally the first time I'm hearing
about it. Oh, well, anyway.
It's been going for years,
Hashtag
Sammy.
Breaking news for you, Sammy. Anyway, I had already been in an internet wormhole researching all the little tidbits of Jamie and Katie. And I just so obviously, when I saw this column, I loved the way the writer honestly talked about why they were compelled by this photo, this really casual photo of Jamie and Katie holding hands, and Katie's just scrolling on her phone. So check out that. We'll put that on the Hub Stop Everything website. And just a couple of texts on delete Facebook before we go. Pinky says, I considered it. I use it for work. So I just unfollowed, blocked everything and everyone. I wish I could sack it off, though. And aggro, I did it a few years ago when the baby pictures and lad Bible reposts got to be too much. You can send us your feedback by email at thehub@abc.net.au or use the hashtag stopeverything. Sammy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, we'll see you next week.
We will.
See you later.